The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order Higher Education Finance and Policy members. You're going to get a large three-ring binder. I would hope you would put your name on it and in it, and then we would mark it up. Now, this is the way we used to do budgets. We marked them up. So we literally went through it. We marked up what we were interested in or where there were problems or where we were sure we could go. But don't throw this away. It is in PDF, so if you want to see a digital version of it, but hang on to your own. And if you want us to keep it on the cart, we'll keep it on the cart. We'll just make sure you get this one back to you. So with that, we're going to start with the Minsky system today. I think the Chancellor and Vice Chancellor, I know the Vice Chancellor is here. Is the Chancellor here? You can tell the Chancellor we do start on time.
He was here.
Mr. Chair, do you need an explanation why I missed your meeting on Monday?
Representative Norris, I don't need any explanations at all. We marked you excused, and that's good enough for me.
Okay,
we don't track down members.
Okay.
Your honesty is beyond reproach.
I have nothing more to say.
tell Arnie Huff that. That would be my only, Minsky's up, so welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. The members have their three-ring binders, and we're ready to go.
Good afternoon, Chair Pawlowski. My name is Stephen Rosenstone. I'm Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It's a great pleasure to be with you today to begin our discussion and review of the operations of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Seated with me is Laura King, our Vice Chancellor for Finance and Chief Financial Officer. Vice Chancellor King is responsible for all financial reporting and oversight, financial planning, internal financial controls, audit controls, and capital budget planning and execution. Vice Chancellor King has been in a role since 1996, the year after the merger, and much of the institutional memory of Minsky is in her brain. The Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal has recognized Laura as CFO of the Year for nonprofit organizations for her work at Minsky. Prior to joining the system, Laura served as Commissioner of Finance for the state of Minnesota, and she serves on various civic and nonprofit commissions, currently chairing as well the Board of Directors of Catholic Charities. Chair Pawlowski, the binder that you and your colleagues have in front of you contains all the data you requested in your January 18th email. Thank you as well for the opportunity to meet informally with you several weeks ago to ensure that we're all on the same page. It was very helpful. And we also very much appreciate your invitation to be working with you and your committee staff to develop a reporting protocol that we can use over the years ahead. The information in the binder is organized by the subject areas you asked us to cover. And realizing that there's a great deal of detail to cover, at the front of each section in your binder is a one- or two-page summary that tries to highlight the key points of the detailed information behind the tab. And the summaries are intended simply to help tee up the topic. They are in no way meant to serve as a substitute for the detailed information that follows. We look forward to answering all your questions and to going through the data in whatever level of detail you think is appropriate. The entire book will be posted this afternoon on the Minsky website, www.minsky.edu, and whatever the kind of slash is that starts in the upper right and goes to the bottom left, I always get them confused, Minsky data, one word. And so all the data that's been shared with you is available to anybody else that wishes to dive in to the facts. I also want to thank staff at our colleges and universities, as well as in the system office, who have pitched in over the last 3 weeks to organize the data in precisely the way you've requested it. As you and members can see, the book is big. It's big because you requested data on a wide range of topics. You requested data for each of 6 years. You requested data not only rolled up to the system as a whole, but for each of our colleges and universities. And Chair Pawlowski, with your permission, I'd like to begin with a mercifully brief, 5 minutes or so, overview of the system, our students, the governance structure, and set the context for our discussion before we dive into the data itself. We can begin at tab one. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is a system comprising 7 state universities and 24 technical and community colleges, serving 47 communities across the state. That picture is there in figure one. We serve the majority of the state's higher education students, more than 430,000 students this year. In fact, the 15 members of this committee together have 53,359 constituents who are attending a Minsky College or University this year. We provide accessible, affordable, quality education to anyone with a high school degree or a GED. Minsky serves students from all walks of life, from those still in high school through PSEO to recent high school graduates to adult learners and working professionals looking to retool or update their skills. Our average student is 26 years old. Minsky Colleges and Universities serve 58% of the state of Minnesota's undergraduates. That's the figure two behind that tab. And if you're to confine yourself not to the undergraduates in the state of Minnesota, but Minnesotans who are undergraduates in the state of Minnesota, that 58% jumps up to 65%. 88% of our students are Minnesota residents. 81% of our graduates get a job right out of college or university in their chosen or related field, and 80% of them stay right here in Minnesota to either work or continue their education. Our colleges and universities confer nearly 42,000 post-secondary credentials each year, 12,000 certificates and diplomas, 16,000 associate degrees, 11,000 baccalaureate degrees, and about 2,200 graduate certificates and degrees. And our colleges and universities serve more students of color than any other higher education provider in Minnesota, nearly 60,000 in 2012. And we have the highest number of low-income students. 38% of our students are Pell eligible. When we think of post-secondary education in the state of Minnesota, 82% of that post-secondary education across the entire state is delivered by one of our colleges or universities, 26,000 students in 2012. And we are dedicated to Minnesota's veterans and their families, serving over 10,600 veterans this year, a 57% increase in the past 4 years. And every one of our colleges and universities has veteran-friendly policies and support services to ensure their success. Our colleges and universities have exponentially grown online education. Now we serve 107,100 students online in over 470 programs. 16,400 blended and online course sections are available to students during the 11-12 academic year. And finally, our colleges and universities deliver 16,000 customized training, occupational and professional classes to business employers throughout the state, ensuring more than 120,000 workers each year stay at the leading edge of their professions. A word on governance, and just a brief word, because my understanding is that you've received briefing.
Chancellor, let's go back to that for a second, and I just want to do a couple of things. For members that just came in, if they would put their names on this binder so that we, if you're marking up and adding notes, that you can return to it. We'll keep it on the cart, or you can carry it, but either way, we'll make sure it returns to you. Secondly, I want to recognize and welcome Representative Carlson, who is Chair of Ways and Means. He is ex officio on all finance committees. To those of us that came to the House when Representative Carlson was chairing higher ed, the outline that I gave you was a pale reflection of what Representative Carlson used to do 4 or 5 days a week when the Higher Education Committee met. He is the one who taught us how to do budgets and to make sure we understood the budget before we actually took a look at proposed budgets, and that we take this very seriously and we ask difficult questions. So we're returning to a system that I think worked very well in the 90s, and I'm hoping even in this age of technology it'll work again for us in the 21st century. So Representative Carlson, thank you, and you're welcome.
Thank you for your time.
Every hearing. Chancellor, on the map, which of these campuses is the newest campus to have been added to the Minsky system, and if you could give me the date of that?
Chair Pulaski, I believe it's Owatonna.
And what was the date?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'd have to look it up. I would venture it was the calendar year 9 or 10.
Within the last couple of years.
It was, Mr. Chair, if I might, Laura King, Vice Chancellor for Finance. It was in service for several years through a partnership with the college and the city, and then we came to the legislature and requested permission to add it to our own inventory. And
so
that's where I'm a little vague.
Let's say 2010 or around that date. You can clarify. When you elevate what was an area that produced courses and programs to campus, how does that change the capital and operational budgets of that campus? Do you add administrators? Do we then have a new capital budget and a new operational budget on that campus?
Mr. Chair, the board considers that when they're looking at real estate, both in the acquisition and the improvement of it. In the case of the Owatonna campus, it was a brand new building and came with little or no deferred maintenance, but it absolutely was added to our stock for which we have responsibility for care.
But that doesn't answer my question as far as then do you create a new operational and capital budget, and what I'm getting at, are we then seeing new hires as a result of the elevation of what was once a structure that just produced courses and programs? Now it's a full campus, so you need a president, you need a vice president, you need what else?
No, Mr. Chair, it was added as a site under the stewardship of Riverland Community College.
All right.
So we did not add a president. We didn't add administrative staff. Unique. They have a manager on the site that handles the walk-in traffic and the building supervision, but we didn't add an administrative structure.
So there's no automatic elevation of administration when that becomes a campus?
No, there is not.
Well, when we get to it, we'll see. Then, Representative Brainerd, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this first page, you mentioned that 81% of graduates get jobs in their fields and 80% stay to work in Minnesota. I'm wondering how that data is gathered and whether you do any post-graduation follow-up.
Chancellor Rosen.
Chair Pulaski, member, we do surveys with all of our students following graduation to do that tracking. So it's not a number we make up or an estimate. It's a result of a diligent survey that's done by all of our colleges and universities.
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, is that done immediately upon graduation, and then is there a follow-up at, let's say, a year after or 2 years after to see how that maintains?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Bryant, my understanding is that it's done within the first year, but it's not done every single year following that. So this is first job out of college or university.
Representative Brainerd.
Just one last question, Mr. Chair. Is there any consideration of giving at least one follow-up to that so we know what the trend is?
Chancellor Rosenstock.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Bryant, that's a wonderful idea. We don't have the resources to do that in addition to the annual survey we do, but we'll take that idea. It's a good one.
Chancellor, there when the university was here for 5 hearings. They had a rather lengthy list of things they're going to be getting back to the committee, so if you want to start creating that list too, we are in the helping the paper products industry here. So job creation is our goal. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, did I say that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just, you know, one of the things as a member of the committee, oh, yeah. One of the things I, as a member of the committee, that I'd like to get some information on is, you know, when I was on the school board, maybe you didn't know I was on the school board for 16 years. Did you know that? No. But what you saw in the rural area was declining enrollment and consolidation of schools, okay? So, which meant we had fewer students. I was in the rural area. And so, but ultimately, when you see that happening all across the state, it's got to affect higher education sooner or later. So, you know, when you look at the number of campuses and the facilities that we're maintaining across the state, how do you evaluate, looking forward, whether to close, consolidate, or, you know, become more efficient in terms of the delivery of the education? I know closing a facility or a campus would be extremely hard, and, you know, there'd be a lot of consternation and reasons not to. But ultimately, when I look at our situation economically, I see the baby boomers retiring, which you're well aware of, 77 million, and I see fewer students behind, and I know we're trying to attract overseas and outstate students, but is there a plan in place where you evaluate the campuses and, if need be, on what the steps would be to consolidate and become more efficient and effective?
Chancellor Rosen.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, the facts for Minsku, and we're jumping ahead a little bit in the book, but I'll give you the preview. Enrollments in Minsku have been up over the last decade 18%, and in greater Minnesota they've been up 13%. So we're not confronting a situation of actually declining enrollments. If anything, enrollments have grown. And as we project out forward the workforce needs of Minnesota, fully 70% of all jobs in Minnesota by 2018 require some post-secondary education. So if anything, we need to be bringing more people into higher education than ever before. The way the system over the last decades approached this is to find ways of creating greater efficiency among, in particular, our greater Minnesota campuses to reduce the overhead and reduce the cost. So one example I can give you, well, first of all, when the system was created, we had 43 presidents. We're now down to 31 presidents because we've combined administration to create those kinds of efficiencies. So one example is up on the range, the Northeast Higher Education District. One president covering five campuses, one administration, five campuses, covering 13,000 miles up on the range. And so the first thing we've done is to try to drive the efficiency of those operations in a way that we can provide access to higher education, because with those kinds of distances, if you're not able to get to a facility, for some courses, you simply have to be at a facility. Some we can do online, but for some, you need to be at a facility. So how to manage the efficiency of those campuses in a way that keeps them affordable and doesn't have extra costs has been a strategy, and we've other examples around that around the state. Going forward, I think you're asking exactly the right question. What's the long-term plan with respect to facilities, the sites, how we deliver education, and how many facilities we need in order to do that? I've charged three work groups last fall to look at the future. One is looking at the future of education. How is we're going to deliver education into the future? Everything we've been thinking about, from MOOCs to online to prior learning accreditations, etc., we need to figure out what our strategy is with respect to those. There's one task force focusing on delivering the workforce of the future, and one focusing on the system of the future, taking on precisely the question that you're asking. I've asked presidents, several members of the board, students, and staff from around the system to serve on those working groups and to bring by June recommendations forward on how to address those questions. There are no more fundamental questions than the three big headings that I've shared with you about the future than those, and we will take those recommendations and come up with a strategy for how to address them.
Representative Gruenhagen.
You know, as part of your thank you, Mr. Chair. As part of your plan, are you looking at comparative data as far as what other states are doing? I'm sure you are, and the amount of students they're serving with the number of campuses they have. I'm sure that factors into your evaluation.
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, the first thing I'm really focused on is what's the cost of delivering that education. And if we can deliver education at a small campus for the same cost as delivering it at a large campus, then at the end of the day, we don't care how many campuses. We just want to know whether it's costing us more to do it at many more sites. That's the first analysis that I think really needs to be done. As we compare our system to other systems of higher education across the country, and you rank them from the ones with the highest administrative overhead to the lowest, we're number 37 on that list. that's a great place for us to be. So indeed, we do benchmark ourselves, not just on how we're doing over time, but how we're doing against other systems. The whole question of how you deliver higher education into the future and what implication that has for facilities, how we do that in the context of the geography of the state and protecting access to higher education is indeed a very important question going forward and one we're working on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Chancellor. I just have a question. At the first page there, it talks about that we provide the education to anyone with a high school diploma or GED, and certainly you also supply that same education, quality education, to non-high school graduates through the PSEO program. And I know on the second page it talks about 26,636. Is that included in that 430,000 number?
Vice Chancellor or Chancellor? Vice Chancellor King? Chancellor Rosenstein.
Jopalowski, Representative Poppy, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Thank you. 4 credit courses, they're included.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and the other question along with that, then, it's the PSEO on campus as well as the college and the schools, which would be at, perhaps at the high school level, and that's also the same, that 26,000 includes that number, is that correct?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Representative Poppy, yes.
Thank you.
All right.
And then I have one other question, if I could, Mr. Chair. Thank you. This is related to Representative Grunhagen's question about the downsizing. And you talked about how you've gone from 43 presidents down to 31 presidents. I would like to know, and perhaps it's in the materials here, how what the numbers might have been in other administrators during that same time period. If you reduce presidents, that may mean that you're not then hiring presidents, but you may be hiring provosts, vice presidents, deans, and others within that administrative level.
Chancellor?
Chair Pulaski, Representative Poppy, we're getting ahead of the story a bit.
Yes.
We have a section of the binder that gives you the details on all administrators in all levels. We'll get to those numbers. The long and the short of it is over the past 6 years that you've asked us to examine, there has not been an increase but actually a decrease in those administrators.
And, Chancellor, when we get there, we assume there will be a decrease in cost, too.
Chair Pulaski, well, of course.
Just hoping that they both match up. But we'll get there. All right, proceed.
Thank you very much. I thought I would just spend a few moments on governance, again, recognizing that you've already received a briefing from House Research on the statutory foundation of the system, so I won't cover that material. As you well know, we're governed by a board of trustees, 15 members, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. One board member must be a resident of each of the congressional districts, and one member must represent labor. Other members of the board are appointed at large, state at large, including 3 members of the board who are students. Board members serve for 6 year terms, with the exception of the students who serve for 2 year terms, and the board elects its chair and other officers. Now, I only have experience here of 18 months and 13 days, but what I can tell you, at least in the first 18 months, is the board's pretty tenacious in its oversight and pretty unyielding in its demand for accountability and results from me and from our presidents and other system leaders. The board also sets policy, including system planning, academic programs, fiscal management, personnel, admissions requirements, tuition and fees, and rules and regulations. The board itself appoints the campus leaders. They appoint the presidents, they appoint the vice chancellors, and, they appoint the chancellor. They examine and approve all major decisions. On the financial side, any decision involving $3 million or more must go through the board committee on finance and facilities, and then to the board itself. All capital improvements are approved by the board. All requests of the legislature are approved by the board. They audit financials, and they track compliance. And so, for example, at the board's January meeting, they reviewed the external auditor's report and were pleased to receive a clean report with no findings, no material findings, for the third year in a row. And finally, the board is engaged in what I would call an ongoing dialogue about my performance and the progress I make on my work plan. Chair Pawlowski, that completes my brief overview. And if it's okay with you and the committee, I thought we'd just turn right into tab three and talk about state funding and enrollment trends. As I mentioned briefly in response to an earlier question, our colleges and universities have grown over the past decade. Enrollment's up about 18%. The largest growth is in the metro area, as you'd expect, up about 41%, but growth has occurred in greater Minnesota, up 13%. It's up 29% at our colleges and up 10% at our universities. As you requested, the enrollment details for each of our colleges and universities for FY 2006 through FY 2012 are listed in your book behind tab 3. In FY 2012, Minsky Colleges and Universities, therefore, are educating over 66,000 more students, or we're producing about 16,000 more graduates a year. That's an increase of about 62% over the year 2000. And those numbers include credit as well as non-credit courses. As enrollments have soared, state support per FYE Minsky student has declined nearly 45% in constant dollars per FYE student since the year 2000. If we look at the state as a whole, not Minsky now, but the state as a whole, Minnesota's total inflation-adjusted higher education state appropriation per student has declined 48% from FY 1999, that's the red line on the chart, compared to an average decline of 23% for the nation as a whole, the blue line on the chart. Again, these are not Minsky numbers. These are state of Minnesota numbers. Put differently, the reduction in the state of Minnesota is among the nation's deepest. In 1999, Minnesota higher education appropriation per student was 24% higher than the national average. Now we're 17% below the national average. So, how have we dealt with the decline in state support? That's the next topic, well, and the details are provided Chancellor, behind tab four.
We've got Representative Winkler and then Representative Breinert have questions. Representative Winkler. Terrific.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, could you describe how you calculate an FYE?
Chancellor.
If I'm not mistaken, and I have my lifeline here if I need it, Chair Pawlowski, FYE is assuming that you take every single student, but assume that each of them were taking a full load. So if you have two people who are each taking half loads, they would count as one person for FYE. So as we've changed headcount, we're not stacking the data if there's a change in the how many are taking full-time versus part-time courses. So this allows for full-time equivalent students taking the part-time students, then adding them up their credits until they constitute a full-time student.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Chancellor, so are you doing it based on total credits and dividing it by enrollees or something like that? How do you, as a practical matter, actually get there?
Chancellor, Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's essentially right. We know how many total credits are sold, and we know how many unique people are enrolled. And we just divide the two on the basis of 30 credits equaling a full-time equivalent load.
Representative Winkler? Is that?
That's, yeah.
All right. Representative Poppy. No, Representative Brainerd, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is probably for Vice Chancellor King. So,
it's a hard one.
It could go either way, but I'm wondering, so this data, both of these graphs are about state appropriation are related to FYEs or full-time equivalent, however you want to look at that. But is it possible for us to have this data in another form where we actually see the state appropriation over the same time frame and what has happened to it just in raw dollars and then in relation to inflation, not related to FYE or to, and I know that student numbers are that there's a correlation there, but it's not absolute, and I think it would help me understand better to have the dollar figure in its own right.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Vice Chancellor.
If it's not in the book now, and I'm not sure it is, we can certainly get it for you. Just what our appropriation has been year over year over year in one column, and what our enrollment has been in a different column. Is that what you're...
Representative Brainerd.
Mr. Chair, yes, to just see the dollar appropriation.
Certainly.
And then if you want to do an inflation-related graph of that, that's fine, but I'd like to see the dollar appropriation itself.
Absolutely.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to talk about headcount a little bit. You've got the chart here enlisting from 2006 to 2012. Maybe it's just that to look at it initially, the Alexandria one kind of stood out since 2011, there was 7,834 students and or full year equivalent or headcount. 2012, 10,095. That's quite a significant jump. So I'm just wondering if the measurement was the same from year to year, and I note that, you know, there was the increase in Alexandria, the decrease at Dakota County, and then the other one that probably has quite a significant difference would be St. Cloud State University, because in 2008, they were at 20,851. They jumped, more than doubled, and then in 2011, dipped to 34,847 and jumped back up, 51,141. I'm just curious about, I think you would probably expect 100, 200, maybe 300 students differentiation between year to year, but some of those are fairly significant.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppy, there's several things going on. First of all, the year you're picking up as the big jump was the first year following the financial crash in Minnesota and in the nation and in the world. And many, many people jumped immediately to higher education, using it as a moment to retool and prepare, since there were fewer and fewer jobs. Secondly, these numbers include customized training and include continuing education. So a change in the mix of programs that any particular college or university might have in a particular year can produce much bigger jumps than you'd expect just on the basis of students joining degree-seeking programs.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chancellor. So is there a listing of what is included in each of the headcount enrollment? Is there something somewhere that says this is how we determined what that is? And I think I didn't necessarily catch your first comment about how the jump was, because the first one, Alexandria, is 2011 to 2012. That's the jump. And you were saying something about the economy, and that's when we're actually starting to get better. So maybe I just wasn't quite following what you were saying.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppy. I was referring, I'm sorry, to the St. Cloud example. Again, each college or university changes the portfolio of programs to try to respond to market needs. And so I'd have to dig into Alexandria to find out why their enrollment jumped in that particular year. We can give you the footnote to the table, but this is both students enrolled in credit and non-credit courses, in continuing education courses, as well as degree-seeking courses, matriculated students in pursuing a specific certificate, diploma, or degree. So we give you a footnote as a follow-up that would give you the details on that. But to your first point, the metrics that are used across time and across our colleges and universities are the same. Across time, across all. So it's not a difference in metric across one institution or between one year and another.
Representative Poppy, you finished?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it kind of goes back to Representative Grunhagen's initial question about dealing with the ebb and flow of numbers of people who live in certain areas. And I was actually surprised to hear that in greater Minnesota it's up 13%. The trajectory, I'm not sure, is always going to continue to be raising, since we are losing students, and certainly high schools are facing that and going down. So I would like more information probably about the headcount. So I'm just hoping that there is more detail here.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in this state funding as it relates to changes in tuition. Can you say a little bit about that? The percentage in decline is pretty outstanding that you've cited here, and I'm just trying to make sense of what that does to tuition costs. Is that something
Chancellor?
You present now, or is that coming later?
Chair Pawlowski, that is a perfect segue to the next tab. So happy to move there if it's appropriate.
Okay, I've got Representative Carlson. Well, Representative Johnson, you finished.
Well, hold on
Carlson
on that
still
one
on
then.
This.
The second question I have has to do with students of color, and what is your impression of how well you're doing in that regard, and what policies do you have in place to further encourage and bring in students of color to the system?
Chance.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Johnson, excellent question, and a question that's going to become even more important over the years ahead as we move in the next, I think it's 5 years, to 25% of all of our high school graduates in Minnesota being students of color. We obviously do a substantially better job in those areas of the state where there's more students of color, and by that I mean not just the metro area, but those campuses that reside in communities where there's large numbers now of Latino students and the like. Each of our colleges and universities has an outreach program designed to bring those students into the college and university and to support them and ensure their success when they are there. We are serving more students of color than any other system in the state of Minnesota, and need to continue to do so as bringing underrepresented populations into higher education, preparing them for jobs, becomes an even more crucial thing, not just for those communities, but for our state.
Representative Johns.
That's okay. I'll hold now, Mr. Chair, I think.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Chancellor, enrollment trends. I'm interested in getting some information on the number of part-time students. I've had the opportunity to meet with some of the Minsky presidents, but if you could create a sheet that would show the number of part-time students by campus. I've met with Metro State. They were able to provide me with that, North Hennepin Community College and a couple of others. And I'm talking, I think, mainly about credit-based. I'm not talking about customized training, but those students who would be in a credit-based course part-time by campus. And unless you've got it somewhere else in the book, I don't see it under enrollment trends.
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Representative Pawlowski, Representative Carlson, be pleased to do so. It's not in the book currently. We will provide it for credit-only students. What I can tell you from looking at the aggregate data for the system as a whole is that over the last, I want to say, about 8 or 9 years, the proportion of students enrolling part-time has increased. That's largely a function of the greater financial challenges that families in Minnesota have been confronting, particularly over the last 5 or 6 years. And it's also a function of communities that traditionally have not been enrolling in higher education needing to come to higher education. So a larger proportion of our four-credit students are part-time, largely because of financial reasons and because they're older. 26 is our average age of our students. So we'll get to the details campus by campus.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Carlson.
You kind of jumped ahead of me. You're understanding why I'm probably asking the question, but I want as a beginning point to know what the numbers are. I'm told like the state universities are about 20% part-time. I'm not sure what the overall percentage is for the two-year institutions, but like I say, I'm interested in knowing what it is by campus. So thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this question may be for you, actually. We spent 5 days with the University of Minnesota, and I'm suspecting we're going to do pretty detailed analysis and discussion with Minsky, and I'm just wondering about the presentation today, maybe. So I'll ask you rather than to ask the Chancellor about. So is the Chancellor going to just take us briefly to kind of introduce different areas of the budget, or is this going to be, we're already on the enrollment trends, are we going to be going back to this, are we going to get more detail on this, or is this kind of our opportunity?
Poppy, we'll be going back to anything. I would hope the Chancellor would be here for every hearing if he wishes to be here. We did not ask President Kaler to be here at the University of Minnesota. We're waiting for the presentation on the budget request, but the Chancellor chose to present, and that's their choice. So I assume he'll be here every day we have a hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then maybe I will ask the Chancellor a question. So, Chancellor, you're kind of going through and saying, okay, now we're on to tab 4, tab 6, whatever. Are we going to be kind of slowing down the process a bit so we're spending a little bit more time within each tab? Or I'm just trying to get a sense of the style, perhaps, of how you're going to present to us. Thank you.
Chancellor?
Chair Pulaski, Representative Poppy, I did not imagine that I'd be the one deciding that in this committee. My game plan for today was that we probably wouldn't get much further than the fourth tab, and that I'm assuming that we'll get into as deep a conversation on anything you want at any time you want. But I did not come today imagining that I would blast through all the tabs as a superficial pass, but rather we'd go as slow or as fast as the committee decided.
Well, Representative Poppy, if you remember the way I ended the last hearing with that small story about Abraham Lincoln rereading a law book 5 times, I have no problem going back over these tabs 5, 6, well, many times it takes until we understand your budget. And I'll give you the same message I gave the University of Minnesota. If we do not understand your current budget, I don't know why we would have any reason to give you more money. So if we can't understand it, you have to be able to explain it so we have a reason to give you more money. That's the bottom line. And that's what this explanation is about.
Chair Pulaski, we completely understand that, and we've done our very best in preparing this book, try to organize the data precisely as you requested it, and we are very comfortable spending with you and members of the committee all the time you need so that all questions are answered.
Chancellor, Representative Winkler is next, but I'm going to just ask, when President Darrell Kruger, who's at Winona State, worked on a funding formula, and that funding formula was abandoned. Can you explain why that funding formula was abandoned? And I ask it because you also know that in the request, we're working on statutory reporting language for higher ed, and the legislative auditor is helping us draft that. So what happened to that formula language, and why was it abandoned? Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, your question in your email prompted us all to go back to the 2005-2006 report that was done by direction of the 2005 legislative session, because it's been now over 10 years. So I had to myself go back and look at the.
But you are the institutional memory, and that's why you're here.
Institutional memory, that's right. And sometimes I need a little help because I couldn't remember the answer to your question. So I went back and looked at it. It goes back to language that was in statute for many years that drove an enrollment adjustment in the base forecast that the Department of Finance produced. That enrollment adjustment then went into the forecasting documents, and then based on what I read in this report, it was completely ignored in the governor's recommendations and in the legislative process for years. In fact, the report talks about an actual, a disconnection between policy and reality is stark, which I thought was a very strong statement. So it was observed by the members of the Higher Ed Committee in that session that the language and statute had not been executed, and so the question was asked, do we want this language or do we want something else? And so a task force was formulated, including University of Minnesota people and MNSCU people and people from the Office of Higher Education and someone from the Legislative Auditor's Office, I think. And they came back with recommendations that the statute should be amended and all of the language concerning the enrollment adjustment, which had been inactive, should be deleted, and that a new provision should be added simply expressing the legislative intent for funding higher education at 67%. So I think the why behind your question is that it was observed that it wasn't activated and hadn't been activated for years, so it was deemed to be obsolete language.
Well, Vice Chancellor King, we can revisit this in my office, I think, and we will. And my reason for asking is, in whatever language we're going to create now for your reporting on the amount of resources you get from the state and how it's spent, I don't want that deactivated either. So we'll revisit it in some detail in my office, and then we'll continue on our quest, because I don't want to take up any more committee time today. I have other members who have questions. But I have a concern as to why that was jettisoned, and I don't think the answer you gave me is the reason why it was jettisoned. So we'll have a private discussion on that.
Mr. Chair, I think your interest in statutory reporting is one we share, but it's different than language that drives the Department of Finance forecasting process.
I understand the difference, but I also understand when things are deactivated, there's usually another reason. So we'll see if that other reason exists. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which of the testifiers can best address this, but going back to this definition of an FYE, it raises the question for me about degree completion or program completion, and which further raises the question. You mentioned non-degree students, continuing education, and I didn't see in this packet as I looked through it a kind of picture of what your enrollment looks like, a breakdown of degrees, non-degree certificates, and I'm not even sure what the continuing education component of your program is. So could you just kind of paint a picture, try to flesh it out in rough numbers, kind of what students you're serving and how?
Chancellor?
Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, we can give you those details campus by campus. In round numbers, of the 430,000 students we're serving, I believe this year it's about 254,000 are enrolled in credit courses, credit to on their way towards a certificate, diploma, or degree. The remainder are in continuing education or non-credit courses. So a large part of what we do is serve people who are employed but need to update their credentials, or we're brought in by a manager of a particular firm saying, new technology coming in, can you help bring our workers up to speed on that? And that's a very large number of the students we serve. But well over 250,000 students each year are served in credit programs. So we give you the breakdown campus by campus of those distinctions.
President Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chancellor, could you share with us a little bit more about that 180,000 or so non-credit courses that you're providing. The question I have is basically the marketability of those non-credit courses to the student if they end up leaving that particular job, or if these are things that they can carry with them. If we're investing in something that's going to stay with the student, or if we are just serving a particular need at a particular time.
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, yes, indeed, we're investing in an individual with skills that are cumulative and they carry with them, they're embedded in them. We are indeed responding to needs in a changing workforce, and those needs are brought to us by the needs that individuals have, but also the needs that companies have. So to give you two extreme examples that I've encountered at the Dakota County Techno College, an individual was displaced from his job. He always had this passion for barbecue sauce. He came back and took two non-credit courses on how to start up his business, and he went and started up his business. That would be among the students we're talking about in the non-credit courses. On the other extreme, Dakota County also has relationships with hundreds of firms in the region. Those firms ask Dakota County customized training faculty to assist in the upgrading of the skills of their employees. Now, those skills, when the employees get those skills updated, stay with the employees as much as they help the firm be productive and more efficient. So I think there's two kinds of things here. One is the individual, and the other is companies asking our colleges and universities to help out.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, and I'm sure we will understand this better as we go through the presentation, but I'm new to it. If a company is coming to you and asking you to provide a certain set of skills for a particular worker at, say, Dakota, how much of that student's education is paid for either by the student or by the firm as opposed to by the taxpayer? What portion of their course is subsidized, essentially?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, another good question. Most of our customized training programs are fully costed out and paid for by the contract of the customized training.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, I'd be curious if you could put, you don't have to do it now, but some numbers to most, just to get a picture of kind of what the spend we're doing in through higher ed to MinSQ for training to the extent that it benefits companies but isn't costed out to them. And I'm sure it is most, but I'm just curious about that number.
Representative Winkler.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chancellor, when you calculated FYE and you total credits and you divide by students, you could have a lot more students coming in and taking credits, or you could have the same number of students taking a lot more credits and not getting to degree completion. I'm not suggesting that that's the case, but that it seems to me that FYE calculation could represent either of those two or both. So do you have trend information about degree or certificate or diploma completion over the same time period so we could compare that?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, absolutely be pleased to provide it to the committee. I think the thing that needs to be clear is we're not trying to hide something by the FYE calculation. If anything, we're trying to avoid hiding something. We can look like we're massive in terms of some of the charts we've showed you if we didn't adjust down for the fact that not every one of our students is full-time. But we'll be pleased to show you, as we found in the earlier questions, for each of our colleges and universities, what proportion are part-time, what proportion are full-time, and how that's changed over time, as well as give you the number of diploma certificates and degrees that we've produced in each of these years as well. Happy to do so.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, that would be very helpful. The thing I get a bit concerned about is students who start and stop their education because of costs and because of financial pressure and lost credits and lost money, lost time, because credits may not transfer, they may not have a good idea of what they're getting educated for, what career is in front of them. They may not have good information about that and how much money that the state is spending, the students are spending, and time that they're spending on things that are not leading to some productive outcome for them. So I think that degree completion trends would be helpful in that regard, but I wonder if you have any other data that could help.
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, I wish this was going to be simple, and let me tell you why it's particularly complicated in our case. We have many programs where students are hired away before they complete. And if we're only looking at degree completion, we might code that as a failing. From the student's point of view, from the business's point of view, it may be a whopping success. And I'm talking about being hired away in $50,000 to $60,000 jobs. And we have many programs where 100% of the students are hired, and many are hired before they leave the program. We have many programs where the recruiters are there day one of the program before the students even begin, wanting to sign them up and create that pathway. So when we're talking about technical education, I think we need to be a little more thoughtful about that context. Secondly, we did an audit, I think it's coming up on 2 years ago now, looking at transfer of credit. And what we discovered is that 91% of the time when a student tries within our system to transfer credit, it works successfully. We've been drilling in on the remaining 9%. And the two largest reasons for the remaining 9% are about 3 or 4% of it we discovered is just a mistake. And when the mistake is brought to someone's attention, it's corrected and the transfer credit occurs. And second, and so we've made sure that there's greater clarity about how the process ought to work with our staff, but also greater clarity about what the appeals process is. So if students feel they weren't treated fairly, they have the appeals process. Secondly, the other part of the reason is a lack of clarity about when students begin courses at one of our colleges, whether indeed it will transfer to one of the universities for one of the majors that they want to take. And we've, with help from our colleges and universities, have much clearer way of getting that information to students, because most of the time it's the course was never slated as part of the transfer curriculum. And so we want to avoid a situation where a student is embarking down a path thinking that she's taking a course that will transfer towards a major when indeed it doesn't. So we've worked hard on that remaining 9%, and I think most of the transfer problems are pretty much under control, not perfectly, but pretty much under control. I agree with you. If a student's taking a course that should transfer and it doesn't, it's a problem.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Chancellor Rosenstone. That is helpful. I suppose that 91%, we don't really know how many classes students take that they don't seek to transfer because it may be in some field of study that they're not interested in or something. And that, I suppose, would be outside that statistic. I guess the question I have is if you could, at some point down the road, provide a tab that explores this issue of completion and it breaks it, and it's complicated, but break it down as much as you want to or as much as it can be helpful to understand what students are actually experiencing and what we're getting for the money that we're investing in these classes.
Chancellor?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, pleased to do so.
Representative Poppy, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler is, you know, that transferability is always a concern sometimes for students because they're taking credits, they're paying out of their pocket many times, even if they get some financial aid. There are other costs associated with that, so they may have some concerns about that. And, you know, as I'll just put in my plug first, you know, Chancellor Rosenstone has heard this from me as well, but as a counselor at a community college, I think that having some opportunities for students to actually get some guidance counseling, career counseling, and assistance is beneficial in the full picture, because if they can start making good decisions, setting some good goals initially, they're going to actually benefit, and it's going to benefit all of us, because they may not be repeating classes, or they might not be taking classes that are not the right classes for them. So I appreciate the opportunity to kind of follow up on that. So, and then I had another question, but now it's escaped me, but it was related to the transferability for students, and when it comes back to me, I will ask that question. But I appreciate the opportunity to talk about counseling. Thank you.
Chancellor?
Chair Pawlowski, with your permission, to try to step back a bit and get a little bigger picture on this concern that Representative Winkler's raised. Part of it is we need to do a better job back in high schools of helping students align their passions and interests with what the right path is to realize that passion and interest. There's a lot of transfer not only within Minsku, but a lot of transfer from Minsku to the University of Minnesota, and though it's not talked much about, there's about 1,200 students a year that leave the University of Minnesota to finish in Minsku, and about 800 of those 1,200 students come to one of our technical or community colleges. So there's an understanding on many in higher education that that first step you took may not be the step that really is right for you. So one of the things we've been working on with Commissioner Casilius is how it is we could take everything we've been learning from the workforce listening sessions we've been doing about where the hot professions are going to be, what the needs are, what the skills are, and do a better job aligning that with the passions and interests of students in high schools so that some of the really hot, interesting, great careers that are out there that are simply not on the radar screen of young people can be, so we get more people starting on the path that has a higher probability of being the right path for them. And that's something we're working on, and we hope to be able to get fixed this year as well.
Representative Wick.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, I think that's a very important set of goals. I think it would be very helpful to me and hopefully my other colleagues here to understand where we are as we look at some of your proposed solutions.
Chancellor, I've had conversations with Representative Marquardt on this topic and on other topics that cross K-12 and higher ed. And for a few sessions in a row, higher ed has not heard some of these topics. So with working with Representative Marquardt, we want to make sure that both committees understand the totality of what's going to happen in some of these programs. You simply can't change how high schools are going to operate and then they're going to be somehow doing a better job in college without us understanding the consequences of that too. And I want to go one step further. We heard from the U, and now we hear from you how complicated this is. It's so complicated that it's just so complicated. I think it's difficult, but I don't think it's complicated that you can't explain it to us. The University of Minnesota and the Minsku system are the best educators we have in this state. I'm giving you an opportunity to educate this committee. And this is going to be the one thing that you need to do to get your budget. Educate us. So it might be difficult, but I think you can take that complicated material and explain it to us so that we can understand it. That's the goal.
Chair Pawlowski, I completely agree with that, and that's precisely the conversation I hope we're having. The only time I used the word complicated was in response to Representative Winkler's suggestion that the only thing we want to look at is degree completions as the measure of success. I was suggesting it was only a little more complicated. If we cannot make very transparent to all members of this committee how things work within Minsku, then indeed we got to keep the conversation going. I am not saying to the committee that things are so complicated within Minsky we'll never be able to explain it. That's not our point at all.
All right.
Part of what we've tried to do in these summary pages is to pull out from all the facts a way of trying to understand at a high level exactly how it works. And so my contention is not it's so complicated we're not going to be able to figure it out. In fact, even as a new kid on the block, I think I got it figured out. I'm quite sure the committee will be able to join me in that process.
Chancellor, we've had five hearings with the University of Minnesota, and the word was used quite often. I wanted to make sure at the beginning of these series of hearings that you understand that the word educate is a much better word than complicated. I can understand it's difficult to educate, but this is the best. You are the best we have, so show us the best. I'm all for it.
As a fellow educator, I will not use the word complicated again in our hearings.
All right. Representative Dorholt.
On the slide you've had up here for a while, it goes back to 1999. I'll spare you the story of when I was a freshman and wrote a check for tuition that year, which obviously can't really do anymore. And I just wanted to, as we go forward, I think that's a benchmark year, and I jumped a little forward to Table 9-1A. I'm wondering, as we move forward, if maybe you could stretch that one out to 1999 and maybe get that to us. I've received it from other entities, but it'd be nice for you guys. And then these are great tables here, maybe 9-2, but I don't, maybe just a couple examples of those going back to 1999. Not every single program, but just a few more reference points going back to 1999 within the Table 9-2 and then 9-1 was just a two-page. That would be great. I think that's going to be important as we move forward, as this 1999 year might keep coming up.
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dornholt, we can certainly do 9-1A and B. I don't know that we can do 9-2.
Yeah, I know. No, I mean, 9-2, obviously, that's very complicated. Maybe just a couple.
We can do A and B for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the transfer issue. I think it would be helpful if we had a chart that talked about the transfer in and out, and, you know, from the community college to the state universities, from the state universities back to the technical college, whatever it might be. So if you have those numbers and kind of the chart, including privates, university, whatever you might have, that would be helpful just to see kind of, because it is, you know, very fluid for some students.
Chancellor.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Poppy. That's actually one we have. It's part of our annual report to the legislature on transfer, so it'll be an easy one to get to the committee.
Proceed.
Thank you. I thought we might turn to tab 4, which gets to the heart of one of the biggest questions. I know, Chair Pulaski, that's been on your mind, and that is, how have we dealt with the declining state support? So let me walk you through how we've done it, and where the pain has been and what the consequences have been. Since 2006, a total of 964 academic programs were eliminated. And as you can see in this table, the 2009, 10, and 11 budget cuts hit particularly hard. Now, and here's where I'm going to be completely transparent, and it's not complicated, but I'm going to educate. At the same time that we cut...
Now you're talking.
At the same time that we cut 964 academic programs, we also added some programs. And you'd expect us to. We added programs in biomed, in nanotechnology, in mechanics, in pharmacy tech, in healthcare, in manufacturing, in math, biology, chemistry, wind energy, welding, and other areas. So there is, at the same time we're doing massive cutting, we're also doing some investment. The net here over this period is 964 programs cut, 568 programs added, or a net loss of 396 programs, or roughly a 9.7% net reduction in the number of programs that we've been able to provide as a result of the budget cuts. A campus-by-campus, year-by-year listing of every one of these programs is there for your perusal under tab 4. Program closures is a natural part of our strategy. It ought to be. if a program is no longer relevant, if it no longer has students enrolling, if it no longer has high demand coming from employers, if it's not cost effective, we should cut it. And our colleges and universities have done precisely that. It was a major strategy in dealing with the budget cuts from the legislature. But I don't want you to think that at the same time we were also not investing. Indeed, we were investing, but the net here was 396 programs eliminated, a reduction of the portfolio of courses that were being available to our students. Now, there's more to it than that. And what we've tried to do is identify for you the things that we had to confront as challenges and the strategies we used to address the challenges. So the pie chart at the left identifies for you what the challenge was between FY 2008 and FY 12. The challenge added up to $325 million total over these years. It comes in a couple buckets. First, over these years, there was $120 million of cut in state support. Second, there are inflationary costs over these years. The price of natural gas did not remain constant. The price of health care benefits did not remain constant. The price of other utilities did not remain constant. We had some contractual salary increases during this period that, regardless of whether state support was being cut or not, we still had those contractual obligations. Paper, supply, equipment, course materials, technology, there are some costs that simply over this period of years went up. We also, and I gave you some examples before, we did make some investment over this period. We would be not doing our job if, where we had high demand for employees, we were not turning out and turning on programs in a very targeted way. And over these 4 years, we made roughly $111 million of new investments. We could not, even during a period of cuts, stand still. But those investments were very targeted to respond to the needs of business and industry, to provide the new programs we need, to invest in technology, equipment, and the like. So all total, it's a $325 million challenge we had during this period to support the investments, deal with the cuts in state support, and deal with the built-in inflationary costs over these years. How did we meet the challenge? We met it in two ways. The largest share of the challenge was met through budget cuts, reallocation, efficiencies, and deferred expenditures. 58% was dealt with in this way. That's the net program closures we just talked about. It was a real headcount reduction in administrative, clerical, faculty, student support staff, and other staff positions. Pay freezes for our faculty. This is the fourth year of pay freezes for our faculty. Deferred maintenance on our campuses, equipment simply not being replaced and no longer state-of-the-art, and much, much more. So 58% of this challenge we met, our faculty met, our staff met, in the mechanisms I just described to you.
Chancellor, there were pay freezes for faculty. Were there pay freezes for administrators, too?
Yes.
Those administrators, did some of them get rather sizable bonuses despite a pay freeze?
Chair Pawlowski, yes.
So in a sense, they might have had a salary freeze, but they certainly got a nice bonus as a result of the pain that was being suffered in other areas.
Right. Chair Pawlowski, I am recommending to the Board of Trustees for their consideration under the new administrative plan that that practice be eliminated.
And I commend you for it. And when we get to the administrative salaries and those bonuses, there are other issues that are relating to how the administrators were treated compared to the faculty and the support staff. And there are issues there when we get to that section.
Chair Pawlowski,
but thank you for telling us about that.
We look forward to that discussion. We have broken out for you the changes in each of the employee groups, and I think you'll see that there's been a change in administrators as well.
And I'm going to ask this in advance. How would you suspect the trustees to react to that recommendation?
Chair Pawlowski, from my preliminary consultation with the trustees, I believe they will support it.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, I jumped ahead to your tab 8 for a breakdown of your salaries, benefits, and other operating expenses, and you mentioned sort of anecdotally, I guess, the increase in costs related to health care, some limited contract labor increases, as well as facilities, typically, I guess, energy. Can you, is it possible for you to get us a breakdown of that? Because when I look at tab 8, I just saw salaries and benefits and other operating expenses without any detail. And we've heard a lot, we've heard mention at the University of Minnesota about increasing costs, and I'd really like to have a much fuller understanding of your cost drivers.
Vice Chancellor King.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, we can absolutely do that. We can show you what our expenses were by major category by year going back to 2006. So we can show you salary and benefits, operating costs, repair and replacement. We'll pull it from the financial statements, so it won't be a perfect match with budget documents, but I think it'll respond to your question. The other thing that I would just point out, though, is that will show you what our spending was in a balanced budget environment. It won't show you what we should have spent on things, which is in part what the Chancellor is talking about here.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chancellor, I think that would be helpful. I'm hoping that you can break it down. And maybe it's just a matter of providing your financial statements, which I suppose I could get online just as easily. But I think it would be helpful to have a breakdown that shows trends over that same period, not just in total salaries, but breaking it down as you see fit in terms of salary versus benefits, different types of job categories, and you know, non-employee expenses, operating expenses, based on whatever subcategories you think are most relevant for us to understand.
Happy to.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the pie chart that talks about the solution of $325 million and 42% was the tuition rate revenue increase, how does that translate then into an individual student's tuition increase from 2008 to 2012? It wouldn't have increased by 42%, or would it have?
No.
Chancellor Rosens.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Johnson. No, the average increase for a full-time college student over these years was $155 a year. The average increase for a full-time university student over these years was $261 a year. Put differently, the biggest driver for the tuition increases that occurred over this period was the withdrawal of state support. But the entire challenge that we confronted over these years was not placed on the back of the students. In fact, 42% was placed on the back of the students. We collectively addressed, from all the things I just described to you, the remaining 58% of the challenge. If the state support had not been withdrawn during this period as rapidly as it was, these tuition increases would have been substantially more modest.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. So that's the punchline. The question that we've been asked constantly has been, how did you deal with the cuts? What proportion of it was funded by the students? What proportion were funded by the changes you made, the cuts you made, the positions that were eliminated, the salary freeze, and the like? Let me try to give a little more detail. This next chart looks at the reallocation and cuts that have been made over the past year since 2006. We project that for this fiscal year, FY13, which is not yet completed, that the number will be approximately $23 million. And when we get to the time of the season when we talk about our request for the next 2 years, we are committing to making $22 million in cuts in FY14 and in FY15. A little deeper dive into FY12 will give you a sense of the categories in which the cuts were made. Of the $53.7 million in cuts, we've given you a little breakdown in the different categories and how much the cuts were made. Cuts in faculty position, administrative and staff positions, general operating categories were impacted the most. In FY12, this included 151 layoffs. It included 276 positions where there were vacancies, simply eliminating those positions entirely. The cuts in these lower priority areas were offset by new investment. We've talked about that already. That new investment meant that in the programs we wanted to increase, we were adding some faculty positions. adding some investment in facilities, adding some investment in administrative and academic support staff equipment, and the like. The net of these reallocations in FY12 was the $33.7 million. And if you go to Table 4.3 in your big book, you'll get the breakdown for every one of our colleges and universities over the years. But I thought it'd be helpful just to get a sense of the balance for FY12 to give you a flavor for the different ways in which it was done. Again, in the spirit of transparency, being clear that even during years we are cutting, we still have to do some reallocation from lower priorities to higher priorities.
Rep. Sam Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, could you, and maybe you have this somewhere, but just talk about the retirement incentive program and if there's a, because it, that happened during those years, I think, so you would have, because that, I think, is different from the layoffs, as you have that described.
Vice Chancellor King.
Certainly. Representative Poppy, you're thinking of the program we call the Board Employee, the Board Early Retirement Separation Incentive Program. It's still in board policy. The policy expires next summer. It was used most substantially in fiscal 10 and 11. In fiscal 10, we had 113 offers accepted for early separation, and in fiscal 11, we had 214 offers accepted. We have in 12, we're showing less than 50 offers accepted and made and accepted in 12. It was a very valuable program for us, and we had good participation. It was not used uniformly across the system or even uniformly at a campus. The way the policy was written, it was program specific, so there might be a program that was made offers, but not the whole college or the whole institution. And so it was useful for us. We saved in the neighborhood of $25 million in 10, in 11 and 12. And because most of these offers were made in 10, the savings might happen over several years, depending upon the staging of it.
Representative Poppy.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Vice Chancellor. Mm-hmm. Will that be, since that's something that is going to be sunset, is that something that is likely to be continuing or based
Mr.
on
Chair,
the success?
Representative Poppy, we have that query out now, and we're not hearing as much interest from the campuses as we heard a couple of years ago. So I can't tell you yet whether we're going to ask the board to extend the policy. It'll depend on whether we have feedback from the campuses that indicates they're interested.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at your little red and green lines here, one of the things I've really appreciated in your article, you were interviewing Enterprise, and some of the direction that we're going is great, because we do need to make sure we close the skills gap, and that means programs for new innovative things that weren't even thought about 10 years ago. And I think you've done a really nice job publicly addressing those and apparently implementing some of those as well. And I guess my question really has to do with the students. When you're at one of the institutions and you're enrolled in a program and that program is going to be cut, is it cut strategically, and is it phased out so that the students that started in a program can finish their 2 or 4 or 18 month, you know, year or 18 month program, or is it just cut and they find a new major?
Chancellor,
you want Representative Pawlowski, Representative Norton, programs when they're cut honor their obligations to students that are enrolled. It isn't we don't honor that obligation for the next decade if you're enrolled, but there's a period of time, usually several years, in which we work out a way in which students can complete that program rather than put them in the street and say start over again.
Thank you.
Representative Nard.
And I really appreciate that, and that's the right way to do it. I assume that's the way you do it, but I've learned sometimes assuming things isn't always the best way to do it. So on some of these programs, when you cut them, you're going to continue to see some savings in years out based on the cuts, although I also note on your it probably costs more to start up a new program, particularly if it's a technical or has some sort of electronic or machinery that you may need to purchase, there's probably some initial startups as well in that. And I assume you're going to have on continue with your philosophy that I've been hearing publicly. You're going to continue to be innovative in starting up new programs. So is the phase out of the programs you've already started cutting going to help you in the green column as you add, or is that going to be part of your request?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Norton, going back a couple charts, the big chunk of program closures were several years ago, so the savings have been realized by now. You're quite correct. To start new programs, particularly technical programs responding to the needs of business industry, have capital investments, investments in faculty, investments in preparing the materials necessary for those courses, and in some cases, capital investments that are buildings and redesign the facilities themselves. So our presidents don't take those investments lightly. They're usually done in consultation with business and industry, a sense of what the market's going to be over the years ahead, a sense of whether, if we open such programs, whether there's actually going to be students there to fill the seats. But we will be returning, when we get to that part of the conversation later in the season, to asking for help for targeted investment in programs that need to be opened in order to meet the demand that we can't meet all by ourselves right now, particularly in light of the deep cuts that have occurred over the last 6 or 7 years.
Vice Chancellor King, you want to respond?
If I might just add to that, Mr. Chair, to your, I think to your interest, particularly from questions and conversations we've had in the past, the board and the chancellor have been very dedicated to multi-year planning, and we can show you some work we've done with the campuses that looks 2 and 4 and 6 years forward, as well as all the financial reporting and budget discipline we have looking backwards. And the reason is because it is we have such a long horizon to impact our cost structure. So to your question, Representative Norton, if I'm sitting on a campus doing program review, which we do every year on every campus, we look at every program, we look at what are the enrollment trends, what are the cost trends, what's the community tell us, and I make a decision that that's a program I'd like to retire, I need to think 24 or 30 months ahead in order to wind that down. And that cost is on me. There's nobody that's going to say, we'll cover your gaps for the next couple of years until you shed that program. So we're very, very disciplined multi-year planners because we have a very long string. You won't see in our budget request a request for the state to cover those costs for us. That's part of what we do on a campus-by-campus basis in our financial modeling. Our request really is focused on what's the innovation and the new thinking that we need to invest in. We carry what we have within our own portfolio.
Representative Norton.
And Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And one thing, I serve on the Jobs Committee as well, and we've had some presentations recently. And the one thing I guess I'd like to ask you if you're seeing a trend toward this, or maybe it's my bias that I think we should have a trend toward this, but in a time that with changing technologies in medicine and in computers and just technology in general, when it's hard to predict and plan for what's the next thing, is there any effort for business to come forward and be a part of planning for these new programs and helping invest in them? The old apprenticeship days, I know we're kind of moving toward internships and apprenticeships. We're talking about those in jobs. Is it time that we need to ask business for a little bit more help, given the times that we're in and the speed of the change?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Norton, yes. On the big question, to use a very overworked Minnesota metaphor, we need to skate to where the puck's going to be. And if we take into account sometimes the difficulty of business and industry knowing exactly where they're going to be, plus even the speediest speed in higher education is not 24 hours. Our customized training can get it down to 60 days, but there's still a lag. And then if we have to deal with the pipeline, going back to Representative Winkler's question, the pipeline of students coming in, it's not a system that moves at lightning speed, even if it's working as best as it can work. So what we've been doing is following the ITASCA a report on higher education. There's a working group focusing on alignment of higher education with the workforce needs of Minnesota. I co-chair that working group with Scott Peterson from Schwann's. Scott Peterson is the HR lead at Schwann's. We have 9 industry representatives from various sectors from around the state on this work group. We have not only Minsky at the table, but we have the University of Minnesota, privates, and the for-profits at the table. We have DEED at the table. We have Chamber at the table, the Chamber of Commerce at the table. And what we're working on is building a system that will do a much better job of teasing, if you will, out of business and industry what their needs are, not today, but where they see them going over the next 2 or 3 years. What we've discovered is some sectors are kind of on this path already. Health is one that's way out ahead. But when you talk to people in financial services or manufacturing, they haven't been thinking the way that health is. So part of what we need to do is build it in a way that interfaces very naturally with the HR planning within those industries, so it's not an add-on for them, but also begins to get them to think a little differently. And the information has to be there in a way that we in higher education can tap into it and use it in a way to make the adjustments we need in our academic programs. Now, what I can tell you is that as a result of listening sessions that we held last year, I followed up with all of our presidents in January, and they've already begun the process of realigning the learning outcomes of their academic programs to align with the outcomes that we heard from business and industry are needed. And they've already begun the process of readjusting the size, location, or opening or closing of programs, again, to respond to what we heard in the workforce listening session. That has to be a natural part of what we do, and a natural responsibility, I think, particularly for Minsky, but for higher education, to respond to those needs. So we're working both within Minsky, but also collaboratively with business and industry, with the Chamber, with Dean and others, to build that system. And if we can get that working right in Minnesota, it's a huge competitive advantage for us compared to other states around the nation. And there's no other state in the nation that's as aggressive and as far along the path as we have been here in Minnesota. So stay tuned. We're on to it.
Representative Nart, we're in possession of your bill. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, Vice Chancellor, just you won't be able to answer this because we'll be running out of time, but of the 964 programs, I'm just curious about, I'd like to see a matrix about how you make some decisions about closing programs and what other considerations you would have, because certainly funding is an issue, but I would suspect that there are reasons why you would always be closing programs and always be creating new programs, and so I'm not sure what a typical number might be. You know, you've got a variation here, and perhaps there was a greater number in some years because of lack of funding. So would like to see the matrix on that. To be thinking about how responsive we are and whether or not you would say, and this probably goes to the Chancellor, about are we being responsive enough to, you've spent some time with business and industry to be able to see, would you, you know, like to see us speed up the process? How might we be able to do that to be better at making that happen? And then Vice Chancellor King, you talked about how you are the one that determines whether or not to retire a program. And so I'm curious about the considerations by the campus or the college and whether or not it's your decision to do that or how that works. And again, I guess
I would like to correct
Vice
that
Chancellor
one.
King.
I would like to correct that one before the day's over. I have nothing to do with the decisions about program closure. Those decisions largely are done on the campus. There's communication with the Academic and Student Affairs Division, really to maintain the program inventory more than anything else, so that we can give you reports like you have here today. But the academic planning, the academic evaluation, the community evaluation, the workforce evaluation, all that work is done on the campus, and those decisions are made on the campus.
Thank you, Mr. Poppy. Chair. Just so as you said, though, it's up to you to retire the program. If I heard it correctly, so maybe I heard it incorrectly, but are you saying that you gather the information and then? No, that was just I heard it incorrectly.
Vice Chancellor King.
Representative Poppy, I must have misspoke. My object really was to say the royal we, that we collectively, all of our presidents, all of our leadership, have to make these hard decisions every year, and they do. That was really my only object.
Representative Franzen, do you have a quick question? Because you're next.
I just want to make a comment.
Representative Franzen.
To Representative Norton's comments about meeting today's demands with business. And I know that my technical school, Alec Tech, does a great job of partnering with our local manufacturers in the district in figuring out what exactly the business needs are today and coming up with the program to meet the businesses' needs. I know that the local businesses sometimes get frustrated because the amount of workers that we need to meet our manufacturing needs, the schools aren't graduating that number. So let's just say Alec Tech were to graduate 100 machinists today. We would have jobs for those people today in my district. So that's a little frustrating, too. And then also I've been talking with Alec Tech, too, to market to women. When I've looked at, and I've talked to you too, Chancellor, about that issue, I've looked at their brochures before on their programs, I've made comments on where are the women, because the only thing that are in there are men. And that's the wrong signal to also send to women when these are really great jobs in my district. And that's about it. I could go on.
Representative Dorholt, you have a motion for us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes from February 11th be approved.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We're going to pick it up here. And Representative Briner, if whatever your question is, make sure you've got it for Monday. And we're ready to go. And members, if you want to look ahead, please do. And thank you. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.